welcome to your Friday post game. I am your host, as always, Malcolm. Well, not as always, but Malcolm Fleschner with me here, my good friend, buddy, longtime companion, Dave Kohler. And we don't have Steve today. We have a stuffed animal sitting in for Steve-O. I don't know whose stuffed animal this is or how it got here, why it's mic'd, because it does not have, it's not like you can't.
Well, I have a voice, Malcolm, and stop caressing me that way.
Okay, awesome. So it does speak, I guess.
Yeah,
We'll jettison him as soon as Steve is done with his meeting and can join us. But for now, we'd like to thank you for watching the Friday Post Game. Terrific panel show today. The power panel was particularly powerful, I think.
Right on. Right. Very.
Yeah, nailed it.
Red meat for the lefties.
So we got Dave's obituaries. We got Weekly World News. We got Totally True or Totally Bullshit. Lots to get to. The first thing I wanted to mention is actually, as you know, we're recording this on Thursday. That's what the jokes are all about. So we don't know what's going to happen on Friday. But one thing we do know about Friday is that it is officially the 10-year anniversary of Anna Kasparian starting with the Young Turks.
Right.
And
we're defining it as the 10th year.
We're calling it that, whether it is or it
it's
isn't.
Close to
it's
accurate.
Close. Yeah. So, and there are going to be some celebrations for her and some acknowledgments, some recognition. But I thought we might take a moment, at least for Dave, to offer some an anecdote or something about his memory of Anna, or something, a thought that you might have about her on this auspicious occasion.
Of course, I did that in the video that we aired earlier today, so I'm not going to repeat that.
Wait, is that going on air, or is that going
I think
to be...
it'll play on air.
So we put together a video of a number of us offering our recollections of Anna and so forth, but that I don't know if members are going to be able, or people are going to be able to see that, or what they're going to do with it. It might just be for her.
Well,
But you know, the vast majority
can't
of people
put me
watching
on the spot there on a recollection of Anna. So.
Well, I will tell mine.
Okay,
and that what I included in my portion of the video, which is that the first time I got in touch with the Young Turks, or I had lost touch with Cenk because he and I both lived in Arlington, Virginia together, and we both did talk shows at the local public access TV station, and then we both stopped and went our separate ways. And then I decided to look him up, and I found out about the Young Turks and that he'd revived his show as this, you know, online show, and I thought that was interesting, and so I was going to be in LA and I wanted to get in touch and see if we'd get together for lunch or something. So I called and left a message on the TYT voicemail. The next day or something, I get a call back, and it's Anna. And bear in mind, the last time I had seen Cenk was on his last show at Arlington Cable Access, where he had called me to beg me to work it as a cameraman, because he would ply me with us with free pizza. That was all they could offer. But and I was like, all right, fine. And so then I get this call from Anna, and she's giving me the and how do you know Mr. Uger routine? You know,
right.
Like, and what is your connection to Mr. Uger? You know, and I was like.
Girl,
my connection to Mr. Uger is that he used to call me begging me to work his show, and I thought I may be exaggerating a bit, but it was a little like that. I'm like, he's not a big shot. That you're this is not necessary.
And
but
it was a young girl. Yeah.
Yeah, she was playing it up anyway. So that was amusing to me. But then eventually came and worked at TYT and got to work with Anna as I produced her The Point with Anna Kasparian for a while and. It was just a pleasure. And it's been a pleasure to watch her development as that, receptionist type, whatever, returning Cenk's voicemails, to now a bona fide, journalism and media sensation.
Yeah. So I also used her as that voicemail person. I went on a long vacation the summer of 2010, I think, and I asked Anna to. I have this one email box, it's old now, it's not the main one I use, but it gets full of spam all the time. So I asked her to log in there every day to delete all the spam for me. Can you imagine asking her to do that now? But the other anecdote I have is the story of how Anna's first day came about is well known, and that's what I talked about in the video. But she was actually hired twice. First she was hired, period, we need someone, come in. And then a few months, so the host was Cenk, Ben, and Jill Pike. We needed that woman, and Jill left. So I was on the phone with Cenk back then, when there were many fewer people who made the decisions. And I said, "So Cenk, now we need a woman.
Guess who's coming? Yeah,
you
just put the camera on Dave, and we'll let them take care of Steve.
We need a female voice on the show. What are we going to do? Jill's leaving." He said, "Well, what about Anna?" I said, "Yeah, Anna would be great." And he said, "Okay, let's use Anna." And that was it. That was the rigorous audition process.
Yeah, that and. That's not like a government contract where you have to put it out to bid.
Right.
But isn't that
get a minority?
How different was that from the standard hiring practice at the Young Turks for the first, you know, 4 or 5 years of the Young Turks
existence? That's how it was.
I mean,
yeah.
And it's weird that, to me, like now when we hire somebody, it's a whole process. It takes a long time, and you get a lot of resumes and interviews and all that sort of thing. And that just was not the case previously.
Are we hiring Michael Wood?
Not that I know of.
Just ask.
So we're reminiscing a little bit about Anna. This being the occasion of her 10-year
right.
anniversary, and offering memories. If you have anything you want to share about your thoughts of Anna, I explained that we made this video for her. At least we all shot portions of it for her. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's going to be public or for members or just for Anna. So I didn't know whether we should tell our stories if people are going to see them later. But
I don't
what
know
the hell?
Anything about it.
Did you make a video for her?
No.
Awkward.
Sorry. All right. Someone wasn't included. Was I invited?
I assume so. Well, I don't know.
I don't think so.
Maybe it's only the people that she felt really special to her.
Perhaps.
Yeah. All right. So, well, anyway, Anna, even though you're not watching this, and not only have you never watched a Friday Post Game, but you also have refused all the invitations to participate in Friday Post Game, we still love you and appreciate you and congratulations.
Well, we
on
do
10
this
years.
Precisely because she doesn't want to do this.
Yeah,
definitely. Right?
Totally. Yeah, you're right. I guess that's true. But yeah, okay. Anyway, so let's move on to the upbeat, chipper portion of your Friday Post Game when we discuss a recent obituary of a person or whatever.
Yeah, but not quite yet. I'm going to do a rare inside baseball.
Okay.
Although
ooh,
it's
inside
not about good. TYT. It's more about one interaction I had.
Okay.
So it was early in the morning, I think earlier this week, and there were very few people here, 3 or 4 of us. And Hannah Cranston from Think Tank came in, and I asked her, hey, what's going on this morning? And she said, oh, I'm interviewing Yellen. And I heard Janet Yellen. I said, and I said, whoa, you're interviewing Janet Yellen today? How did you get her? And she said, Dave, I'm special. I got my connection. And she was so proud of herself because I was so impressed that she was interviewing. But I heard wrong. It was Jessica Yellen from CNN. When I found out, I was so, but I didn't let her on to her. She's really proud that she impressed me. Because I thought she was interviewing Janet Yellen.
Well, one time, Dave,
Janet Yellen, for those who don't know, is the head of the Federal Reserve.
Right. And Jessica Yellen is someone who comes on to Think Tank to interview with
them. So that reminds me, one time my wife and I were walking in Brentwood past a newsstand. And there was an issue of Playboy. And it said, girls of the SEC. Mm-hmm. And my wife says, what? There are that many attractive women working at the Securities and Exchange Commission? Like, you're such a nerd. No, Essie. And then she felt foolish. But it reminded me of that story.
Yeah. Although it's different, of course. I know the difference between Janet Yellen and Jessica Yellen, but I heard improperly. Speaking of the SEC, although I don't know if it's SEC or ACC, but so Duke
lost.
Duke
is ACC.
Yeah, but they lost to South Carolina. I don't know what league South Carolina's in.
SEC, I think.
And it's because the NCAA doesn't play basketball games in North Carolina anymore. So they used South Carolina as the venue.
So wait,
because of the bathroom.
But they lost to South Carolina in the game, or they lost?
And the game was played in South Carolina.
Well, don't they? Aren't they? These are all set well ahead of time. This is the regional, wherever the regional was.
Almost always there's a round in North Carolina,
okay.
But not this year. And so it was like a home game for South Carolina, and Duke suffered the consequences of their bathroom bill.
So Duke is paying the price, and they probably didn't support the bill either.
And they deserve to pay the price though, for other reasons.
Yes.
Coach K and Bobby Hurley, I don't know.
Bobby Hurley.
Christian Leitner.
What an asshole. Cherokee Parks, these guys are dicks.
So, all right.
Tommy Amaker.
No. All right,
so you have a long standing grudge against Duke for some reason?
No, I'm not a Duke hater like most people are, actually.
Yeah, that'd be a double whammy for Hannah if you told her you hate Duke and you weren't actually impressed with her guest.
Right, I wasn't impressed by her guest.
Oh well. All right, so do we have your obituary? We should mention that the curious coincidence of both Chuck Berry and Chuck Barris dying within like a week of each other. Chuck Barris being the creator of The Gong Show, I don't know if the Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, the movie was about him, and Chuck Berry, and I would get those two confused a lot as a kid, and then for them to die, it's sort of like, a little like when Carrie Fisher and Debbie Reynolds both died that week.
Right.
I mean, Chuck Barris was probably so heartbroken about Chuck Berry's death that he also.
So I just recently watched Back to the Future with my kids a couple weeks ago.
Me too, weird.
Really?
Yeah.
And my kids loved it.
It's a great movie.
They absolutely, and you know, I loved it. I loved it all over again. It's my first time watching since it came out in the theaters in the 80s. And you know, my oldest daughter loved the music from it too, including Chuck Berry.
Yeah, some of the music is the Huey Lewis in the News. I'm a little
nervous. Yeah, she doesn't like any of that stuff, but she liked Earth Angel, and she liked Johnny B. Goode. Mm-hmm. And she added it to her playlist, and just like a modern version of those songs by other groups. And she listens to it all the time. But that movie was so good, and I didn't even know about Chuck Berry until that movie.
Oh.
So, yeah. I only know 80s music, that's it.
Well, it was an 80s movie, so that explains how you would have access to it. All right, so you're not talking about either Chuck Berry or Chuck Barris. You are talking about someone, the audience, they would have no idea who Chuck Barris is. I mean,
nobody cares. Yeah. Come on, the Gong Show. Yeah. Move on to the other one.
Yeah, no one knows who this guy is but that's the point. So I'm going to use your notes because this is the key. We're going to talk about the passing of the most essential reporter the nation has never heard of. And that's exactly what we do on this obituary. We highlight the passing of people who should be noted but weren't.
Except that they got obituaries in the New York Times.
Yes, and lots of laudatory awards their whole lives. So this is Bill Miner, who was a journalist working for the New Orleans paper, the Times-Picayune, but he was assigned to Mississippi, and he was a critical journalist exposing what was going on in the South during the Civil Rights era. And, well, pretty much, yes, he was the voice of the civil rights era.
I'm not sure if that's how they would describe it.
No,
journalistic.
A journalist who exposed the true nature of life for African Americans in the South in the pre-civil rights and during the civil rights era. He covered all the iconic events, the sit-ins, the marches, the trials, the desegregations. He was there for all of it. And he's he's noted as one of the three reporters who brought all these stories to national attention.
But he grew
He's
up
the conscience of Mississippi.
But he grew up poor in some rural part of Louisiana, and there was no indication that or why he should be any different from everyone else who grew up in that small town of hating black people and thinking they're inferior and so on and so forth. And yet he developed a passion for journalism, and so he went to work for a newspaper. And
right, and I think he started in sports.
Maybe I didn't see that part.
But he quickly moved on. And he didn't work for the New York Times or Washington Post. He worked for the New Orleans Times-Picayune. And he was assigned to Jackson, Mississippi. And it's as bad as an assignment as you can get. Yet he was there for one of the most important parts of American history.
And he stayed his whole life, even after the civil rights movement had subsided or whatever.
And one interesting note, so there was a senator from Mississippi, Theodore Bilbo.
Bilbo, yes. I was bad, Steve. Yeah, look at that. Theodore G. Bilbo.
That's awesome.
And he was a racist segregationist through
Bilbo
and through.
Bilbo was?
Yeah.
Yes. And he died in, 1947? And this Bill Miner, the reporter, thought, okay.
Did he hate the orcs more?
Exactly.
Sorry, that's a terrible dad joke.
But with the passing of Bilbo, he thought, okay, the last of the racist senators is gone and it'll be a new era for civil rights. Boy, was he wrong. Yeah. The guy who replaced him was named James Stennis, who was the king of racist segregationists in Mississippi during the civil rights era. And his partner in Mississippi was James Eastland, who was another massive segregationist. So, yes, he was a generation off in predicting that.
Well, and he also seemed to think that it would just.
But racism is now dead.
Now it's
now we're now cold. Yeah, Mississippi, no racism at all.
But that's Bill Miner, who is not Miner. He's Major, and we want to honor him on this obit segment.
All right. Now, you also had something you wanted to say about the recent. We have a sports report.
Yeah, it's so okay. So.
That was pretty funny. It's amusing little story.
So we're in the middle of World Cup soccer qualifiers, and these are great, intense matches played in the countries. They're not played at neutral sites. So Argentina is visiting La Paz, Bolivia, to play Bolivia in a qualifier. La Paz is the highest altitude major city in the world. And
no fire department.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, because there aren't fires, because the oxygen level is so low.
That's nonsense. Major teams, Brazil, Argentina, they lose in Bolivia all the time in La Paz for Bolivian home games. So this time the Argentine team prepared. They gave all their players Viagra before the game, thinking that that would prepare them for the high altitude. And they arrived, they thought it was a brilliant move to arrive 2 hours before the match so they wouldn't have time to get altitude sickness. And what do you think the results of the match were? Oh, and Leo Messi.
Well, yeah, Lionel Messi couldn't play because he was suspended. That's not inconsequential. Right. But you would still think the Argentinian team would be strong enough that they could beat Bolivia.
They haven't won in La Paz in 7 years.
Wow.
And they lost 2-0 to Bolivia.
So I like the idea that they're trying to play with raging boners.
Right, they have raging boners. And that's bullshit about arriving 2 hours. You get this altitude sickness quickly. You should arrive a day earlier and acclimate. Not 2 hours. They might have had half of the team probably had altitude sickness during the game.
I just watched highlights, the two goals that were scored. And the second goal, I think, watching it, it looked like the goalie wasn't even trying. I was like, did he get bought off or something? And probably not. He probably was just suffering from altitude sickness or had a giant
And by the way, Bolivia's horrendous at soccer. They're in the bottom every year of
qualifying. They must beat everybody when they come to La Paz for, you know.
Yeah, it was not all the home games are in La Paz. Some are at slightly lower altitudes.
Where does that come from? The idea that Viagra is going
I'd
to
never heard
counter. What is it supposed to counter? The altitude or the blood
effects
flowing?
Of oxygen deprivation. Yeah, I don't know. It keeps the blood flowing. Maybe that. But it all flows to one area.
Well, you know, Griffin over there, he's half Argentinian, so you should ask him.
Oh, he should speak up.
Huh? All right. So let's move on to the fun. Unless you have anything, Steve, anything you want to talk about? Anything you want to share? Discuss with the inside baseball. Any stories about Anna? You have nothing?
No, I got nothing.
You know who she is? You know which one she is?
Yes, I know who she is.
Okay, well that's something at least. All right, well let's play Weekly World News. Irma, if you wouldn't mind. Weekly World News. It seems like it's so important when I have a graphic, and as the voiceover work is stellar. So you know how it's played. We cull stories from around the world,
and then get them wrong.
Turn into a quiz. Oh, I got to give you guys your letters, of course, because I can't get by without these. So I will. I got five news stories from around the world, and I will posit. Or I'll read what the story is and then give a portion of it where it's from. And then the Steve and Dave will have four options to choose among as to what the actual story is. Three non-stories.
To give Steve a chance, I'm going to handicap myself and not use this one.
You're so magnanimous and merciful. I go with A.
Okay, Steve is tired of losing, so he's developing a new strategy. You're like Shaquille O'Neal with free throws, Anything, whatever it
takes. Am I that bad?
Yeah.
No, actually, I'm worse because he's at least 50%, right?
No, I don't think so.
He was like right around 50%. He was 50%. 52 maybe. I'm below 50%.
Right, but everybody else was much better than 50%. It's not like Dave is like blowing you out of the water, generally speaking. But anyway, okay, so let's move on to the first story, which comes to us from the China-Taiwan region.
Oh, advantage me.
So there's China, there's Taiwan. But we know where those are. So the question is as follows. It's coming. There it is. In an indication of worsening China-Taiwan relations, the Chinese government recently did what? Was it A, sailed a warship within 10 miles of Taipei Harbor, B, cut in half the number of commercial flights allowed between the two nations, C, detained a Taiwanese human rights activist, or D, sent Taiwan a 5-ton shipment of fortune cookies with no fortunes inside?
Oh wait, can I have that back?
I got my answer. All right, I got it.
Oh, so you are guessing, or you're okay? So, all right, and we got our answers. We got an A from Steve, from Dave, and a B from Steve. What is the correct answer, Irma? Bring up the, bring him up. The correct answer is C. Has detained a Taiwanese human rights.
It's amazing how we both get them wrong so often. If it weren't for my epic fail at this, Dave would be ridiculed too.
I think
it's like one right, I get zero right.
I don't usually like toot my own number. I deserve some credit for making up stories that you guys always find plausible.
It's brilliant. It's brilliant. It's very well done.
I think A is true. China's been provoking Taiwan for months now.
Now, this always happens. Dave gets it wrong and he argues it anyway.
I don't claim that anything is, all that I claim is that this is what I discovered. I'm not saying, you have to, it's sort of like Match Game in that, or Family Feud. It's not like necessarily getting the right answer. It's getting the answer that I picked.
I got
so,
it.
Okay. So the name of the activist is Li Mingche. And I think we have a picture of him. It's the only picture I could find of him. It's a little weird looking. It looks like an avatar. But He's an NGO worker who was detained on suspicion of endangering national security.
He's like a Chinese Fisher Price doll.
Yeah, it's a little weird. I don't know what that photo is, but it was the only one I could find. So his whereabouts are unknown, and he disappeared on March 19th after crossing from China crossing into China from the semi-autonomous city of Macau. And so he has previously worked for Taiwan's ruling Democratic Progressive Party, and since the election of Tsai Ing-wen, relations between the self-ruled island and Beijing have worsened. So relations between Taiwan and China sort of ebb and flow. China considers Taiwan still a part of China. Taiwan considers themselves independent, and this has been going on since 1947, or when the KMT, Civil War ended, and they were driven out by Mao and the communists.
It's kind of like U.S. and Texas.
Not really. No. So apparently this guy had traveled to China back and forth frequently over the past decade without incident. But his detention is the first of a foreign NGO worker since a controversial law regulating foreign NGOs in China came into effect. And I guess human rights workers and those who monitor these things between the two countries are concerned that it represents President Xi Jinping's tightening of his grip on civil society. And then the last part about it was why he was detained. It's friends in Taiwan believe Li was being held due to his efforts to tell mainland Chinese friends about Taiwan's political culture. He used WeChat, a Chinese messaging service highly susceptible to government monitoring, to discuss China-Taiwan relations, democracy, and Taiwan's president. And so that's why I didn't get a whole lot of information, but it does seem to indicate a chilling of relations between China and Taiwan, and maybe in the larger scheme of things, China feeling like it can flex their muscles a little more. Donald Trump is not; they're not worried about him. I don't know what he's going to do, but
neither does he.
Maybe it's unrelated. Maybe it's just internal Chinese politics, and Xi Jinping is consolidating his power in anticipation of getting re-upped for another round as premier or president. I don't know. It could be a lot, but it's nervous. It's worrisome to note that China is doing this.
Yeah, can we bring the map up, Irma, again on the main monitor? So, if you know very little about this, you judge the strength of yourself by who your opponents are, and you look at this. That country, China, their big enemy that they're always fighting is Taiwan. That seems like, in a Dr. Seuss way, absurd.
Yes,
and it diminishes China. China ought to let that go, and if they want to oppose people, they should bully on someone their own size. Pick on someone their own size.
But that's purely geographical, and the density. I mean, I don't know what the population differential is, but
GDP is comparable too, probably.
No, but the population density of China is much, much less than Taiwan, no doubt. But you're gonna look at Dave's looking it up. All right,
I'll get it later. And by the way, Shaq shot 52.7% from the line.
I nailed it, 52%.
But that's over his career. Right, so he had seasons when he was doing worse than that, and that's when he would, he might have had some seasons when he was hitting like 55%. He was like, nailed it. So, anyway, that's pretty good. You got it right on. All right, so let's move on to the next question, which comes to us from where? I believe it is Swaziland. That is Swaziland. Speaking of little countries next to big countries, that is Swaziland, which is almost entirely surrounded by South Africa, and then we'll find out more about it in a moment. What's the question about Swaziland? That's what we want to know. And it is as follows. As part of what he calls the Pan-Swazi movement, Swaziland's king seeks to do what? Is it A, annex large portions of neighboring South Africa and Mozambique? B, distribute Swaziland-themed books, movies, and music across Africa? C, invest millions in turning the national soccer team into an international powerhouse? Or D, encourage citizens to give bad Yelp reviews to all the nation's crappy restaurants? The Pan-Swazi movement.
I can only imagine how much time you waste making these quizzes up, but I love it.
All right, do we have our answers?
Yes.
All right, we have Steve says B, Dave says C, and Irma, what is the correct answer, please? Correct answer is A.
That's amazing.
Annex large portions of neighboring South Africa and Mozambique. I got to remember to read the full answer aloud because, and I'm sorry I didn't do it the first question, because there's some people who are listening on the podcast and they don't see it. So yeah, it's A, annex large portions of neighboring South Africa and Mozambique. So what's the story? Okay, well, King, his name is King Mswati III, I believe we have an image of him addressing the UN. There he is. He's the last autocratic ruler in sub-Saharan Africa, and he wants to take really large swaths of South Africa and Mozambique, including the administrative capital of South Africa, Pretoria. And the argument or the claim is that large areas of South Africa and Mozambique belong to the Swazi nation and had been taken during the time the region was under British rule, and that there's lands, wide expanses of land in the east, west, south, and north that really rightfully belong to Swaziland. And I'll just read you a quote from Thabiso Masina, the committee's ex officio member from the Attorney General's office, who said, "Land was lost to the Swazis as a result of concessions to the white settlers around the 1840s, but no Swazi king had ever signed the land away." So the guy's saying, look, you know, there were concessions made to settlers, but the king never said that this is your land, so we want it back. And I anticipate that he's going to get all the land that he wants. They're just going to hand it over to him anytime now. But we got a potential land dispute in Swaziland and South Africa.
The story has only about 1/1000th of the implications of the China-Taiwan conflict.
You're saying it's not as big a story? You're probably right. All right, let's move on to question number three, which comes to us from Austria. Where is Austria, you ask? Glad you asked. Let's take a look into Central Europe and find Austria. There it is. It's right in the middle.
As central as you can get.
Yep.
What's the one directly above it?
That is
Czech Republic.
Germany, Czech Republic, Slovakia, and Poland, and then we get over to Slovenia.
Wait, that long one over from Poland, that's not the right. Is that the shape of what country is that?
That's Ukraine. Germany. That's Ukraine.
That wide?
Right. Yeah.
That's got to be distorted somehow.
How about the one that looks like a boot? What country is that?
Okay, let's find out what the question is, Irma, shall we?
Russians should just take the eastern half of that country.
That's a good idea. You should talk to your friend Putin. All right. Irma, we have the question here from Austria, number three. The Austrian government recently requested what from the European Union? Was it A, permission to initiate bilateral post-Brexit trade negotiations with the UK? B, recognition of Austrian as a separate language distinct from German? C, an exemption from having to accept any more asylum-seeking refugees? Or D, a dramatic increase in tariffs on low-grade imported Russian strudel?
This is obvious.
Obvious, so obvious.
So obvious.
So obvious.
I'm not going to go with the obvious.
Okay, so we have Dave says A, and Steve says B. We have answers of A and B. The odds are one of them is going to get it right. Irma, what is the correct answer? Obviously, it's C.
That's Wow.
Well, C is the obvious answer. I'm surprised that.
So we have 2/3 chance of getting it right if we guess different answers.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Because D is not correct.
Yeah. Because we all know D is not correct.
Yeah.
So there's three questions in a row where we both got it wrong.
Yeah. This is
the chances of that happening is pretty low. Okay.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
basically 1 out of 27.
You're possibly yeah. I mean, if you both have to guess.
Separate, different
answers. Yeah. Well, I'm sure one of our fans will. One of the proud 19 will figure out what the actual odds are and post it in the comments.
I think it's 1 out of 27.
And if we got two more questions to go, Steve, it could go higher. All right. So this put briefly, Austria is asking for an exemption from having to accept any more refugees from Syria and the various other places because they feel like they've taken enough, even though they made an agreement to take in more, but they feel like other countries aren't living up their agreements, their rights. I think we have an image of some. These are refugees making their way into Austria, and it's also an attempt to quell the internal politics of Austria. The far right Freedom Party is rising in influence, and so the more moderate elements are trying to forestall or put off or keep them from gaining more interest from or popularity by Instituting their own right-wing measures, one of which is to say, no, we don't want any more. So, I mean, and in Austria's defense, the country, they took in roughly 90,000 asylum seekers in 2015, which is more than 1% of their population, whereas in Germany, more than 1 million migrants have come to Germany. But like 1% doesn't seem like a lot, but in the United States, if we have a population of 350 million people, that's 3.5 million.
It does seem like
it would be a lot.
Yeah.
And so, but I, you know,
is the math correct on that? Can one of the members fact check that, please? 1% of 350.
So Austria is calling on other EU countries to take their fair share and has backed the idea of financial penalties for those who do not. And I think, you know, they all sort of signed an agreement saying we'll take this number, we'll take that number, and but it's all in the details. It gets confusing, and they're claiming that they lived up to their end of the bargain, and others in the EU are saying they haven't. But I think this is, you know, potentially just a bellwether of what's going to happen with the migrant crisis and people getting tired of it, and it's people in Europe specifically and deciding enough is enough, and the possibility that it will just, you know, worsen more and more, and the countries.
Do you know how
many
refugees there are from just Syria right now?
I don't, right now, how many refugees are, like, in camps and the like, or who have been settled? You know, I don't know, but
5 million refugees out of Syria. It's a global humanitarian crisis. Now, tell me, why are we in Syria?
Well, are we in Syria? We have a couple of people there.
Well,
we're bombing Syria. We're bombing the hell out of Syria. Do you know why? And do you even know who we're bombing? Do you even care? I'm just asking a general question.
Well, I know what's going on. I might have some gaps in my understanding, but I don't know where you're going.
My point is, we are contributing to a global humanitarian crisis where 5 million people are displaced, and, you know, like 150 of them just died recently.
Well, there's nothing to say of the people from Afghanistan, from Iraq, from Libya, other places where we have, you know.
Right, but just Syria for right now. But we have no clue what we're doing there. We don't know who we're bombing. We don't even care. It's never in the news. I mean, there's some news about the refugees if there's a massive incident where a bunch of them die. But we don't talk about the root causes of this crisis. As a country, we don't seem to care at all. And I think that's just unbelievably shameful.
Well, we don't care about Yemen, which we're even more responsible for, which is another humanitarian crisis. There's a humanitarian crisis going on in East Africa. I mean, there's us not caring is, you know, part of the course.
But this seems worse to me because it is literally the worst humanitarian crisis right now. And we have dropped so many bombs in Syria that we're running out of bombs. So it's, I don't know. Sorry to bring it down, guys. Got to talk about your
friends. No, I mean, I want to cover these stories because they are important. I mean, that's part of why. I mean, it's supposed to be fun, but it's also because on the main show, it's like, aren't we as guilty as anybody else in covering these stories?
Yes. Like, I mean, I would argue that less than 10% of Americans know what we're doing in Syria, who we're bombing, how many people have died, and what the different shifting alliances are. Because we theoretically hate the Russians, or not hate, but we're at odds with them. However, we're kind of coordinating efforts in Syria.
Right, because they're ostensibly fighting ISIS, who we're fighting, but we're also fighting Assad, and they're allied with Assad.
And we're funding the folks who are against Assad.
The moderate rebels.
Yeah, so what's going on?
It's a clusterfuck.
Oh, it's horrible.
And people get frustrated.
It's been going on for 5 years. It's not like it's just some new story here.
Right, but 5 years into it, the vast majority of Americans don't know and don't care.
Okay. That's an upbeat report from Steve. You're not even going to be on Aggressive Progressives tonight. You could be, you know, delivering this on Aggressive Progressives anyway. All right, we got a little lighter, next we go to India. Where is India? Who knows where India? There it is. We all know where India is. So the question is this: what unusual behavior has been witnessed recently among wild parrots in India?
Damn it! Where's John Graziano?
Is it A, raiding poppy fields to get a high from the flower's opium? B, an increase in same-sex coupling that's reducing the bird's population numbers? C, cooperative behavior with rhesus macaques to pick and eat wild Karanda cherries? Or D, the electric slide?
If you had gone with the mocker instead of the electric slide.
Hey!
If you had gone with the mockerade, I would have picked that one.
Could be almost anything. All right, do we have answers, gentlemen? All right, we do. We have one says answers. B. One says C.
Someone's going to get this right.
Somebody's got to get it right, don't they? The correct answer is A. Raiding poppy fields to get a high from the flower's opium.
Wow.
Now we need a mathematician.
We can't be this bad if we tried.
Maybe we should try then.
They're going to think you're throwing it on purpose because the odds against this are, you know, pretty long. But anyway, wild parrots have been raiding poppy fields in India in order to get a high on the flower's opium. The birds, they sit perched in trees near the poppy fields, until workers slip open the pods to help the plants ripen quicker, and then the parrots silently fly down, cut off the stalks, carry the flower back to the tree where they nibble on it and get their buzz and fall asleep and nod off. Sometimes they fall out of the trees and die because they're looking for their buzz. But there's a consequence for local farmers who are required by the Indian government to provide a pre-agreed quantity of opium annually for medicinal use. At least that's what they claim. And the drug-addled parrots are cutting into their earnings. The farmers have tried everything from firecrackers to beating tin drums and hurling stones, but nothing keeps these parrots from getting their fix. So
that's an amazing story, actually.
It is pretty amazing, and I mentioned it to John Graziano, who's a colleague of ours, and he keeps parrots and is a big bird nut, and he said that all intelligent animals, given the opportunity, will seek to alter their consciousness, and which explains why a lot of Republicans have never tried drugs. Hey.
I thought all intelligent animals would cooperate with monkeys, given the chance.
Yeah, I made those sound so specific that, the Karanda chai. I looked up some obscure fruit in India that, nobody would have heard of and thought.
Nasi was an excellent red herring. I was like, that's so good, it's got to be fake. Yeah. So I went with the obvious B.
I feel sorry. All right, let's get on to the last one. Our last question, it's also a fun one.
By the way, the odds, if Dave and I both chose separate answers, to get all four questions wrong is 1 out of 81.
Okay, all right. So we're going to go over one, we're going to go to 1 in 243. Let's see. The last one, this is redemption. And we're going to Brazil for this one. And the question is, what happened at a recent Brazilian wedding after gunmen broke in? Actually, it was just one gunman, I'm sorry. After a gunman broke in and shot 3 guests. Was it A, the priest performing the wedding pulled out a gun and returned fire? B, the couple went ahead with the ceremony? C, the bride-to-be ran off with the gunman? Or D, the DJ put on 80s music, which stopped the gunfire as everyone, including the gunman, started dancing? That was for you, Steve.
Thank you.
All right. What's it going to be? These are tough. Do we have answers? All right, Steve has an answer.
Oh, shit. We had the same one.
All right, they're both saying B. What is the correct answer, Irma? It is? Oh, yep. And the correct answer is?
Is? Newsflash.
B!
Yes! We both got
Congratulations.
It.
Congratulations. Good job, guys. I'm so proud of you. What is that, Bart? What is that noise?
It's just a bell.
It's just a bell. Okay, just it's not bell. From a game show or
it's
anything
not
like that.
Ferris.
Okay, so this is the story of Jailton Barbosa and his wife Christina, who I think we have images of. A hitman busted into their wedding before the ceremony and opened fire on 3 guests. It was a revenge shooting. None of the guests all survived, but he believes that a few years ago the people he shot were responsible for killing his father, brother, and one other person. And there he is. As guests are filing in, he walked in behind and just started shooting people.
He's the guy in the glasses?
He's the guy in the back, yeah. So it was a failed revenge killing. And his name is Humberto Ferreira Santos. And he was just inches from the victim when the attack took place. But the bride at the time was still outside of the church. They get medical attention, and the couple say they waited in the church for 2 hours after the shooting for word of their relatives, and when they found out all 3 would survive, they pushed on and they held the wedding anyway. The bride said, to cancel everything would have been like allowing evil to get the better of us. We were innocent in all this, and we just wanted to get on with our lives. what was upsetting to her, apparently, was that after news spread that the attacker was still on the loose, around half of the couple's 300 guests did not return after 2 hours for the wedding party, and that is what upset the bride because there was so much food they had ordered. And so there's a wedding going on. It's before the wedding, a guy comes in, shoots 3 people, is chased out or runs off. They get medical attention for those 3 people, and a lot of people stay in the church waiting to find out how they are. They're going to be okay. Like, okay, let's just go ahead with the wedding. And then, shockingly enough, a lot of people didn't want to go to that wedding. We're like, I don't feel in a festive mood, especially knowing the guy who shot those 3 people is still out there and could absolutely come back and shoot some more people. But the bride was like, how could they not? How could they not? We had all this food.
What about me?
What about my needs? All this food. So that's your humorous little story from Brazil, and that is how we play Weekly World News. 1 for 4, both of you went 1 for 4, which is above average for you, Steve, and a little bit roughly average, maybe a little bit below average for you, Dave.
Yeah.
So good job, everybody.
We all learned a little something.
But thank you, and let us know what you think of all these stories in the comment section, if you don't mind. And now we can move on to the next segment. If I'll take those. The next segment in the evening's entertainment, which is Totally True or Totally Bullshit with Steve O and Malcolm Fleshner. I believe we have an intro for that also, don't we? Boom! It is a shame. A little
so
bit.
Good.
It's so good. It's a little bit of a shame that the best thing about the segment is the intro. Yeah. And that's also true of Weekly World News, unless you get them all wrong, in which case it's pretty humiliating for you. I appreciate that you say you still like the game, because I know initially you said you would like it if you won and you beat Dave. But now that you say you like it, even though you're not, you don't typically tend to win, that means a lot to me.
Thank you.
All right. So how we play Totally True or Totally Bullshit, I will, offer a proposition, and then the panel here will discuss whether it's A, totally true, or B, totally bullshit. So what's our first one, Irma? All the members in the comments section telling us to hire Michael A. Wood Jr. are actually Michael A. Wood Jr.'s sock puppet accounts. Totally true or totally bullshit? So this relates to last week's postgame, which involved Michael A. Wood Jr., our close friend and former police sergeant with the Baltimore Police Department, and a police scientist. He likes to be called a police scientist now. So if you could update all your LinkedIn profiles accordingly. So at the end of the show, I guess you guys were talking, well, Dave wasn't here, but you were there, so you were talking about whether we should hire Michael Wood, and he said something like, tell him how much you want them to hire me, and so there were like a dozen or two dozen comments, oh, you should totally hire Michael Wood. And so my question is, are they really members, or are they sock puppets? I said the positive is that they're sock puppets. Is that totally true or totally bullshit?
It's totally true.
Totally true.
Really?
What do you think?
Is that influential?
No, that would mean
he's making fake accounts.
Yeah, that he's making
fake accounts himself.
Right.
So it would be
he hired a firm out of Russia.
Yeah.
To basically create these accounts and make these comments. Well, sign up for membership and then make these comments. It's obvious.
No, hack in. They're not going to sign up for membership. They hacked us. But I'm going to make a point now that we've determined. Well, I haven't gotten here.
Totally bullshit.
Totally bullshit. Well, I'll say totally true, and I'll go in the comment section and just put fake, respond fake news to each one,
right,
where they're saying that he should be hired. So, but if they're not, if they were not sock puppets, then there seems to be a groundswell of support for Michael A. Wood Jr., but I don't know what we would do with him specifically.
Michael is a great addition, and I would love to hire him. And there's a, like you said, a groundswell of support for him. But that's the way it is with everyone that comes through, right? Our audience likes him for the most part, and they say, "Yes, you should definitely hire so-and-so. You should definitely hire so-and-so." We can't hire everyone. That said, I do want to hire him.
He also provides, as some people pointed out, a necessary balance to the unattractiveness of the usual panel, which is now a number of people have had to ban them from membership because they said this about us.
They're not talking about the postgame show, they're talking about the Friday Power Panel.
Oh, it's the Friday, oh, I see, okay, good.
Oh yeah, we're known for our handsomeness.
Right, it's the Friday Panel.
Yeah, so Michael Wood is also a good hire because he provides free security.
Yeah.
He's like the one tough guy here that could fight.
Oh, what are you talking about, he's a huge cuck. All right, so let's go on to the next totally true or totally bullshit. This one comes to us from Dave Kohler. And I edited it down considerably. Dave sent
still
me this
pretty
thing.
Long.
It was about 80 pages long. Jenk focuses too much attention on the DNC's role in Hillary Clinton's primary victory over Bernie Sanders and not enough on many other important factors that contributed to Hillary's win and that must be dealt with before the Democratic Party will once again achieve electoral success. Totally true or totally bullshit? Dave, I ask you.
Well, it's totally true. I proposed it. And again, it's not that I'm not defending the DNC. They were biased in favor of Hillary Clinton. They tipped the scales and they did everything wrong. But that's just one factor. And I think Hillary Clinton, we all know, is the biggest name in politics. And she got a lead in those Southern primaries before Bernie Sanders, the Bernie Sanders movement came to full speed. And it was going to be hard, if not impossible, to overcome that lead.
the Democratic establishment could have gotten behind Bernie Sanders, especially the superdelegates who actually matter.
Yeah.
But that's not the DNC.
But that was not going to happen. But they're part of the same establishment,
yes,
though, obviously.
So if the word had been establishment, then it's totally bullshit, that thing. The establishment was in favor of Hillary Clinton and biased everything toward Hillary Clinton. But just talking about the DNC, that little organization headed by Debbie Wasserman Schultz.
That's your whole complaint. I thought there was more to it. I thought you were going to talk about structurally what the Democrats do and how they conduct campaigns and recruit candidates and all this sort of stuff.
Sounds like you should talk about that.
Well, I mean, not my question. I just, I'm just transcribe. I just edit and transcribe.
But no, I'm not ready to talk about it. But yes, those are all the things. She didn't win just because the DNC was behind.
Right, you're saying that even they didn't need to put their thumb on the scale. She was going to win anyway.
Right, but you're right. I mean, why were her only choices Sanders, Martin O'Malley, and Hillary Clinton in the first place? It goes way back, of course.
But that's the same thing because the Democratic establishment cleared the field for her essentially,
right.
And Bernie didn't even want to run, and Martin O'Malley, he had nothing better to do, so why not?
Yeah,
he wanted to roll up his sleeves and get to work, Martin O'Malley. Should ask Michael Wood about the Martin O'Malley next time he's on, because he's was former Baltimore mayor. So, yeah, I mean, I thought the question you were posing was about wider changes within the Democratic Party than just, okay, we shouldn't talk about the DNC, we should talk about the Democratic Party establishment. That's your quibble seems like it wasn't even worth the question after all.
Oh, sorry, but we can talk about that. I wasn't prepared to attack the Democratic Party.
But I mean, I guess the question is whether the DNC is, or the establishment control of the Democratic Party is the be all and end all, or if that's just one aspect of the problem that Democrats have. I mean, it seems like the core of it, it seems to me, is that the Democratic Party wants to have it both ways. They want to take the corporate money and they want to be the party of the people as well. But you can't do that. The Republicans are saying, fuck the people, we're just going to take the corporate money and we'll lie and say whatever we have to get them to vote for us, but we're not going to do anything that's really actually going to help anybody. And so the Democrats are saying, we will say we're going to help you and we'll do a little bit, but nothing that's actually going to piss off our donors. So nothing, the kind of substantial things that Bernie Sanders talks about.
Yeah, you're right. And that's discussed to death on Aggressive Progressives, which you two are huffing on, and the main show, and even here during the primaries on this show. So, I don't have any.
But I think it is a worthwhile discussion to have about what are the specific changes that need to be made to the Democratic Party and how do they need to go about. Like, if Keith Ellison had won the DNC, I know you don't like to talk about it, but what are the things that he should have done about allocating resources and funds? I mean, it seems obvious in retrospect that the Democratic Party or the Hillary campaign should have spent less money on TV ads and the bullshit in states that she couldn't win, and more time on the ground doing get out the vote in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin.
But
that doesn't make money for the Democratic Party establishment.
They need, Democrats need to realize that Republicans are actually fighting ruthlessly to take power. The Democrats are just saying, we're going to go along here and see if we get votes. The Republicans started this decades ago at the lowest level of politics with the redistricting and getting state legislatures, legislators in.
Voter ID laws.
Yeah, voter ID laws to suppress the vote. So
and by contrast, this is something that just really, really irritates me. When the one nationwide organization that was doing tremendous amount of voter registration of poor African American Latinos across the country, in urban areas across the country, was a video, a doctored video came out about that group. Did the Democrats stand up and defend that group? Because that group was
called Acorn.
Acorn. That group was critical to building a Democratic base in these cities, and they just let them go. They just said, fuck them.
So the Democrats suck, and I could talk about this all day long about how much they suck. But we have to be careful that we don't conflate or we don't make Hillary Clinton synonymous with all Democrats. Hillary Clinton almost won and could have won if she didn't bungle a couple of things,
tactics.
Right? Yeah. So, focusing on at the presidential level is actually, it's a red herring, okay? I'm using that term twice today. because
Steve didn't get lunch today, so he's.
I didn't, I'm actually starving. So the problem is the Democrats are getting wiped out at every single level. So yes, Hillary lost because of Russia, but because of sexist, because of Bernie, and because of Joe, and because of Jimmy Dore, right?
You can make Susan Sarandon and James Comey.
Right.
Yeah,
it they hatched the plot
together.
He can
make every excuse, and if any one of those things go away, then she would have won. It doesn't address the core problem of the Democratic Party, because it's a party that doesn't stand for anything. They stand for we're not as bad as those guys, and we don't hate gay people. That's really all they kind of stand for. They never stood up against the destruction of Acorn, and you know, and in the fights against you know, everything from Planned Parenthood to workers' rights.
They wouldn't even stand up for Merrick Garland, for fuck's sake.
Of course not. But he was set up to fail.
Who would?
And that's the problem with the Democratic Party. They don't stand for anything. Republicans stand for tax cuts and deregulation, and basically answering to their donors. So those people who like that, they go. They also stand for being ugly, ugly, ugly against anyone they perceive as being others. You know, LGBT. Minorities, Mexicans, Muslims, whatever. So those people who are into that, they all go out there. But what do the Democrats stand for? They really don't have a coherent message. And it's not just the messaging, it's also their policies. Their policies are pro-corporate. So yes, they say nice things about, you know, racial harmony, and they say nice things about, you know, LGBT rights, but they don't really address pocketbook issues at all.
Right, because those things, the social issues, are not going to piss off anybody. That's what their base of big donors are, socially liberal, but they still want their own want their tax cuts, yes. Or they, at least they don't want you to raise their taxes. Yeah.
So you know, they've never really fought for progressive values and progressive policies. They never made the case for why it makes sense to raise a minimum wage, why that helps the entire community, why it won't hurt jobs. They don't make a strong case for universal health care. In fact, Hillary says it'll never, ever, 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 ever happen. Pie in the sky. Forget it. You guys are being too crazy. And the Democrats are the ones who basically allow the Republicans to pass their horrendous agenda. I mean, they're complicit in so many ways. And I know there are differences. Okay, I'm not saying they're identical. My point is their differences are not enough to bring enough people to the polling stations, and it's not enough to really get people inspired to get behind a candidate, except for Bernie Sanders. I mean, he filled stadiums because he had a message that worked, you know, and he doesn't change his message because he's talking in red states versus blue states. He makes a very strong case for why these progressive values and these progressive policies work for the vast majority of Americans, and that message resonates. I mean, he got. You know, some redneck in the deep red South saying, yeah, I agree with you. Every American should have health care. It's a simple thing. So anyway, that's the problem with the Democratic Party. It's not just a DNC. It's just that they are really kind of lost.
This is true. And well, that's what they're fighting over right now, is what is the soul of the Democratic Party going to be moving forward? And it's mind-boggling that you can have people like Nancy Pelosi coming out and saying, "No, no, the Democratic Party is strong. We're going forward. We know what we're doing, and we got a good plan and what we've done."
They lost everything,
but it worked for her.
They've lost the House, they lost the Senate, they lost state houses all over the country. There are so many states that are controlled by Republicans at every single level, at every single branch of government. They had a Supreme Court vacancy. They lost that too. They lost everything. And for Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer to pretend like everything is great, well, it is great for them. They still get the donor money. They have their leadership positions, and they dole out the money that they collect to other Democrats, so they keep getting voted as leaders. But it's a sinking ship.
It's frustrating. It's incredibly frustrating. Yeah. Dave, anything to add?
No.
All right, well, I think we're going to wrap it up there, I think, and take off. But thank you very much to everybody for watching. We appreciate it. We love you, members. Please comment, because Gigi, she needs to read the comments, and maybe we'll add a segment in the future where we respond to comments. So, I mean, we love
to read comments. Just say that you like Gigi. It makes her really happy.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. And try to pretend you're not Michael A. Wood when we know you are. All right, so until next time, this is Malcolm Fletcher for Dave Kohler, Steve-O, saying
stay strong.